Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A while back, I was sitting at the airport waiting for my flight when I was approached by a woman around my age asking if she could come up and say hello. She was dressed in her airline uniform, and her coworkers came up behind her to explain that she was very nervous and that they were there for moral support. The conversation quickly turned into what I expected was coming next. She was a big fan of the whole Vampire Diaries world. She had seen every episode of the Vampire Diaries, the originals, and legacies. Well, I was prepared with my stock answers for her stock fandom questions. What did the blood taste like? Like a gross, thick sugar syrup. Are Ian Somerhalder's eyes that gorgeous in real life? Oh, yep, you bet. But then she threw me a curveball. She started to cry. Now, if you've seen the news at all lately, it is not a good look when a traveler is making anyone who works for an airline cry in the middle of their shift. Couple that with my discomfort in being on the receiving end of that kind of overwhelming emotion, and I suddenly felt the urge to shut it down. Please don't cry. Nope, it's okay. I loved the show too. I too am a TV watcher, so I get it. I feel the same way about the Bravo franchises. She took a breath to collect herself. You don't understand, she said. I watched the show when I was going through my divorce. She began to explain how watching Caroline Forbes, the character that I played, grow into who she was meant to become as a person and, yes, even as a vampire, meant something to her. Caroline Forbes learning how to move through her tragedies encouraged this woman to look at the road ahead of her and realize that she could do the same. She could take on the unexpected storylines she was dealt with in her life and be the badass vampire in her own storyline. Suddenly, I was the one fighting off tears, which she tried to dispel only for me to explain that I know how she felt. How, as dumb as it may be, binge-watching housewives shows with a warm blanket has been shockingly therapeutic in ways I did not expect. Now, I don't know if I'm necessarily getting the same life lessons that she got from Caroline Forbes and all of the inhabitants of Mystic Falls, but the Bravo Network has given me somewhere reliable I can go when it all just feels too much and I need to give myself a break. I've always loved TV. I am not a movie buff. Please don't ever pick me for your bar trivia team if the category of the night is film. But TV, I'm your girl. TV was a big part of my adolescence. I loved growing up with the kids on 7th Heaven, falling in love alongside Joey with Pacey Witter on Dawson's Creek, hanging out with all of my favorite families on Friday nights like the Winslows, and hoping that one day I'd have a teacher who cared like Mr. Feeney. I considered these shows and characters to be my friends in a way. I guess it's not that far of a stretch that in a year like the one I've had, I found myself turning to television to hang out with at night when I just couldn't sleep. I never thought I would grow up to be an actress, especially one lucky enough to win the TV show lottery. It's been an interesting experience as someone who is such a fan of TV and TV characters to find themselves on the receiving end of a fandom. But lately, my favorite part has been the conversations I've had with strangers all over the world relating about deeply personal things that are beautiful and complicated and so very human, all because I played a vampire on TV. Today's guest is not only a fan of The Vampire Diaries, she is also a movement lawyer, political commentator, and writer in New York City. Olami Olurin is Bahamian Nigerian and was born and raised in Nassau, where she lived until she moved to America in 2008. After getting her law degree, Olurin became a public defender at the Legal Aid Society in New York, where she represents people who cannot afford representation, who unfortunately and uncoincidentally make up the vast majority of the people churned through the criminal system. Olami answers all of my questions about the abolition movement, and I answer all of her burning Vampire Diaries questions, including some behind-the-scenes tea about that infamous tree-kissing Klaus and Caroline scene. So stay tuned. We've got a great conversation for you. First, I've always been curious. Do you hear from John Oliver's team before you just like end up on John Oliver? No freaking way.
I had no idea. I was sitting down preparing for my show for the next. Actually, I lie. I was watching House of Dragons, doing all my commentary on that. I was in the house, big calling Viserys Beetlejuice. And then suddenly I start getting tweets at me like, Alami's on John. Congratulations, you on John. I was like, excuse me, who? And I was like, I was not anywhere. I'm thinking they mixed me up with somebody, giving me some kind of congratulations for people. And then I look and I was like, no idea. Not even the faintest of clues. They said nothing to me.
That is wild. And and just for anyone that hasn't seen this clip, I think it's very significant because I just watching you on Rising, yes. I would imagine you have a lot of deep breaths before you go into filming. But you are able to get your point across in such a cool, calm, collected way, which I think is not as common right now currently in the political sphere of the world. Yeah. So when you are going in to sit down at that table on Rising, is there anything that you kind of tell yourself before you begin? These aren't just like, here's the pop culture news of what's going on in the world. Here's what, you know, so-and-so wore on the red carpet. I mean, and this isn't even just political fluff. These are very big stories and topics and heated conversations that you're having.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I'm a public defender, so I'm so used to being in an adversarial environment, just like a literal adversarial environment where everyone's against me. It's usually the prosecutor or the judge or the prosecutor or the court officers, and they have so much more power than like Robbie on Rising and the people on Rising, right? So it's actually, I know, like for everybody else, when you consider what your day-to-day environment is, I'm like, it's a chiller environment than my main job. So I look at it like that. So one, it's a little bit chill, but two, I remind myself, there's nothing you can say in one conversation that's going to make anybody get rid of their entire worldview. Like, I don't go into it with the approach that I need to convince Robbie or whomever else to like become an abolitionist with me or get on my agenda of things. I look at it like this is an opportunity to get this information out to the public. You know what I mean? In this response, like, I'm not really trying to convince Robbie. So I don't get, you know, my heart and my feelings aren't really in it for that degree. It's like, all right, I'm here to see how people who are listening to it or maybe haven't heard either one of our positions or how one would respond to it can hear that. So I approach it from that perspective and not really, I'm not vested in it. You know, it's not really Alami versus Robbie to me. It's like, all right, I'm here to respond to this. Because in real life, I wouldn't even have those conversations. in real life, my mom, anytime she watches it, she goes, why can't I get this chill Alami, this reasonable Alami that's having to come? I'm like, mommy, so such a foolishness. So it's for the environment so people can get the info.
Do you talk about politics with your family?
All day. Me and my mommy. Yes. My mommy is, she just wants to be a contrarian, because I always call her my moderate example of the moderate I've got a weird now. But she's really not that moderate. She just becomes a moderate to be my adversary. It's just like, she'll see me on the news. She's saying she 100% fostered the environment for me to be who I am. Then she'll see me on the news and be like, why can't you leave Nancy Pelosi alone? Why do you have to talk about Eric Adams all the time? Leave my Democrats alone. And I'm like, mommy, you don't even live in America. You can't vote. You don't live here. How are they your Democrats? So yes, we do talk politics all day.
Where's your mom?
In the Bahamas, where I was born and raised.
Oh my, and you moved into the state. You moved to the States in 2008.
Yes.
And I just would love to know the route of making the decision to not only go into law, but to go into becoming a public defender.
Yes.
Pretend you're talking to a child, because I didn't even apply to college. So for me, the whole like college sphere and even how you go into law school and then determining like what type of law you're going to do is completely foreign to me. Did you know you wanted to move to the States to become you wanted to go into law?
Yes, absolutely. My Grammy told me I was going to be a lawyer since I was a little kid. She saw that for me, like immediately out the game. I think I used to walk around our house with a clipboard, with a to-do list, real intense agenda, shows we got to watch, what we got to do. And my Grammy's like, lawyer. And so I always knew that was going to be the case. And then when I was 14, I convinced my parents I wanted to move to America. That the answer to why my child teen self was hell-bent on America, I don't know. But I wanted to move to America. And when I looked into it immigration wise, it was like it would be easier if I entered the schooling system earlier to become a lawyer there. So everything in my house is very presentation. You've got to convince my parents of everything. So I did a presentation. This is why I sent me to America. My daddy was like, no. My mommy was like, yes, actually. And she sent me. And my daddy, he was a little grim for like a year and he got accustomed. And afterwards, my sisters followed. But so originally I knew lawyer. And then when I got to college, I thought I was going to be actually maybe like a divorce lawyer for the drama. I was like, ooh, at the time I was like, that'll be salacious. And then what happened was I was writing, it's what I studied, like race and the criminal system and systemic racism and discrimination. That was my area of focus academically. And I was writing a thesis called Colored Bodies Matter, our relationship between power in our bodies. And my thesis advisor, Dr. Kathleen Sullivan, wonderful woman, called me a gap scholar, which is an academic term that means it's somebody who points out the problems in academia. Like they point out the gaps. They don't necessarily have solutions, but they point out the issue. And that's a necessary purpose. But at the time, I remember the Ferguson protests were going on. And I remember feeling like, you know what? The criminal system is disproportionately, Black people are disproportionately represented. But when it comes to legal representation, we are 5% of attorneys. And I didn't feel like it was sufficient to be a Black person that becomes a lawyer and didn't do anything that directly served the community. So in that moment, I was a public defender. That's what it is.
And then just for anyone that doesn't really understand what a public defender is.
Yes. A public defender is, first of all, we're the only constitutionally mandated attorneys, but public defenders represent poor people who can't afford legal representation, which is unfortunately the vast majority of our legal system. So if you are arrested and accused of any crime and you can't afford representation, the court appoints a lawyer to you, and that would be me.
Ooh, and day one of being a public defender, did you know what you were walking into? And even when you were moving from the Bahamas to the States and going to law school, and as you began your academic journey into not only law, but also learning about the law within the United States, were there things that surprised you, or did you know what you were walking into?
Oh, I knew nothing. So when I came when I was 14. So I didn't come for.
Oh, you were 14.
I was 14, and my parents, like my family, still lives in the Bahamas. So I came alone. So no, I knew nothing. I was not prepared at all for America on any level. I want to say, just at all. I just didn't know. I feel like even the dynamic of racism by itself, without even recognizing the criminal system or anything like that, that was pretty unfamiliar to me too. Because the Bahamas is a Black majority country. So everybody, the majority, we're all, you know, we don't have that same system. We don't have a massive police state or any of those things. So, you know, I get to America and all of a sudden people are, you know, they stereotype me, but I don't even know the stereotypes. I can't even put it together. I don't know what anyone's saying to me. Like I remember once, I think one of the first stereotypes someone presented to me was something like about Black people not being able to swim. I'm from an island. We can all swim. So I'm just like, I can't even figure it out. Like, they're being racist. They're just not making sense to me. So it's like years and years of like, what's going on? What is everybody talking about? And I went out for context. So the first year in America, I was in Florida. Then I went to West Virginia for boarding school. So I was in West Virginia by myself, and I was the only Black girl in my entire class. And then I went to college in Ohio. So it was a process. And then, but by the time I became a PD, on the first day, I will tell you what is surprising about it was realizing it's not academic. In the sense, I think when you study racism and you study the criminal system, there's so much, we are constantly being bombarded with information and the reality of how discriminatory our criminal system is. But when a system is taught to you as a justice system, you have faith in it that that's what it does. And you think all these injustices are outliers, or you think it's something you have to parse out or you have to like statistically find. I was not prepared to walk into court and it be as blatantly discriminatory as it is. I think that was the thing that surprised me. Like, oh, this isn't something I gotta like look for. It's right there. So.
Was there a point where that deterred you? I would imagine a lot of feelings came from that experience.
Honestly, no. It made me just recognize how necessary of a function the work that I have to do is necessary. I think the first time I really, so in arraignments is when you get bail. When you're first arrested and charged with a crime, you wait to get in front of the judge to hopefully get bail. So we have a bunch of cases. And I remember I had a black guy that was accused of having a blunt, and they asked, same prosecutor, same judge, back to back. This is back to back my pile of cases. The prosecutor asked for like thousands of dollars bail on this black guy for the blunt. Immediately after, I represented a white guy that was found with a bag of drugs, and they consented to his release. And I remember looking around like,
is anyone else seeing this?
Yeah, you're just gonna do this? That is the Candace. That is exactly the amount of times I said, I feel like I'm in the upside down. I'm looking around like
11. Oh, what's going on? Yeah, where is what's happening?
Yeah. So for me, I think that like kind of helps with my work and everything I do with advocacy, because I'm like, this is happening regardless of, you know, how, who's seeing it, how we're responding to it, who is the person I'm conversing with. This is the system. So I actually prefer, even if it's adversarial out in the world, or to advocate for these things or make it known to people, that's better than when I'm in court just wishing somebody could see what I'm seeing. And I'm looking around like, and you can't tell, you know what I mean? You're in court, they have it set up. It's not a coincidence that despite the fact that criminal courtrooms are open to the public, you're not allowed to record or take pictures or do anything, because the average person cannot go sit in courts. Criminal courts, they don't have a criminal case. Why would they be in court just sitting down watching the proceedings to know what the system works like? But we could show them theoretically, but they won't let you. And why is that? So that's what most of court is you as the defense attorney, knowing that if you could talk to the larger public, a lot of people would feel what you feel, but you're by yourself. So you're just like, somebody hear this. Like,
what year did you start where you were in the courtroom, you were done with school, and you were in the rhythm?
2018. Yes.
Are there, in especially within that first year, as you were finding your own footing within, you know, public defense law, what, and if I missay anything that's like a totally wrong lawyer thing, please interject and educate me. But what was there something consistently that you began to see? And we're obviously working towards, I wanted to talk about police, you know, police reform in the prison abolishment movement, but abolitionist movement. What was the consistencies you saw in the people that you were defending?
They're poor. That is what all your clients have in common, just across the board. Everybody. So anybody represented by a public defender, which is the most vast, you barely see private attorneys. And when they do, they have maybe one case, one or a few cases, but everybody there is a public defender and they're represented by public defenders. And when I say poor, I mean dirt poor, like little to no income. Like, people don't really realize there are people sitting in jail, dying in Rikers off a few dollars bail, a couple hundred dollars, you know what I mean? Thousands of dollars, like money that would not seem large or ungettable to other people, but people sit and they spend years of their lives in prison. You know, in America right now, we have over 2 million people incarcerated. 400,000 of those people are being held pretrial, haven't been convicted of anything. They're just there because of cash bail, because they're poor. So poverty is the thing that I think all of my clients have in common. They're beneath the poverty line. Because I identify as the broke. I identify as the poor, but I would not qualify for my own services. If I was arrested and charged with a crime, they would tell me I don't qualify. I have to pay for an attorney. I can't afford no attorney. Lawyers are incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
So to get a public defender, you have to literally be no income. And that's the majority. 9 out of 10 people in your criminal system are that. So poverty. Universally, poverty is the thing all your clients have in common.
And the offenses that a lot of people are coming in for, I think it's easy for the public to assume that it's like, everyone's a murderer, everyone's Jeffrey Dahmer or this serial rapist. And it's not.
It's just wildly not reflective of our system. So 80% of cases nationwide are misdemeanors, traffic offenses, or nonviolent offenses. Most crime, despite the fact that we sensationalize this crime as violent crime, we talk about violent crime all day. First of all, violent crime is a legal definition. So somebody can be charged or considered a violent criminal or been convicted of a violent crime and no one was harmed, no weapon was used, that it's just called violent crime. Certain things are just classified as such. So that's one. But two, violent crime is incredibly interpersonal. You know, it's very rare you even have those cases. Most of what I represented, over 1,000 people. And if I had a dollar for every time I said this is a bullshit case, I'd be a rich broad. Like, so rich. The kind of stupidness. I tell my mommy every time I used to do a thing, after every arraignment shift I work, I call my mommy and I go, you know, you'd be in jail if you were in America. Every time I'd be like, jail for you. I just call my family members up and I'm like, jail for you. The first time I realized you could get arrested for cursing people out, I was like,
you can get arrested for cursing people out?
That is aggravated harassment in the third degree, Candace. If I text you and I cuss you out and you call the police on me in New York City, you are going to jail. Like, I'm going to jail. Yes, it is a charge. That is what so much of interactions are, people like roommates. I'm mad at my roommate. I cuss my roommate out. Yes, I can't tell you.
Yeah, what is the craziest like case that you've seen come across your desk where you're like, how is this actually, we're going to take the time to go in front of a judge to even discuss this?
Oh, I have so many of them. Let me tell you, the one that came to my mind immediately was, this made me mad. I represented a guy who was charged with menacing because he ate yogurt with a butter knife in Walgreens. Like, yeah. You know, like, instead of, because you ever didn't have a fork or a spoon, you use a knife?
Yes. Yeah. I was just traveling with a friend and she used two knives to make chopsticks because they were out of forks.
Exactly. So he used a little knife, like a little knife to eat his yogurt. Menacing. Arrested and charged that man with menacing. You ate that menacingly. I am afraid. That's the kind of foolishness. Or I have a guy who was charged with criminal mischief because for banging on his own apartment door because he locked his keys inside and he was banging to, like, hope his roommate hears it and comes and gets him. Someone calls the police and the police say, well, you don't own this building. You're not the legal custodian of the building because you rent here. So you don't own this door. So banging on this door, criminal mischief. That's the kind of stupidness. And I cannot tell you how many, like, that's the norm. Like, that's the regular kind of thing. It's just like, why is the criminal law involved here? Why is this what's happening? Or people call, they're like, the amount of cases of, like, mothers and their children just having regular familial mother-children disputes. And the problem is we live in a world where you think, you know, the police will come. You see it on TV. The police will talk to the kid like, hey, be nice to your mom. And instead, so mothers will do that to threaten the kid like, oh, come give him a lecture. And what they do is they arrest their children. And now in New York City, we have a thing, automatic orders of protection. So anytime you make any allegation, it doesn't have to have any violence, any danger, anything, another party is involved, they automatically set a full order of protection. Now, how that works is most everything in the criminal system is involved with somebody you know, someone you live with, your family member, your neighbor. So now, if there's an order of protection, if I call, let's say I had a roommate, and I call the police on my roommate because my roommate pissed me off, we got into an argument and the police arrest one of us. They set an order of protection. Now my roommate is evicted. Like, they can't live here anymore. So now they're homeless. And that's most of what happens. So, you know, people think you feel like you're doing God's work and you get people out of jail. It's like, I got them out of jail and now they have nowhere to go. Now they're on the street. And that's so often. And I cannot tell you, let me tell you the worst part is, even if it's your place. So let's say, Candace, you let somebody stay in your house. You could come stay with me for a day or whatever. And they make you mad. They call the police on you. You get arrested. Now there's an order of protection. You cannot go back to your own home. I cannot tell you how many clients I have that have lost their own homes and apartments because of another person who doesn't live there, who has no legal right to be there. Or they call the police themselves on this person and they get arrested and out of order of protection and they can't stay in their own home. that is the most common, I think, that I see in the system.
And these are not cases that are necessarily then just thrown out once you actually get, they are.
No, they're not thrown out. Not at all. That is
and
the
this
norm.
Doesn't happen just in 24 hours. Someone walks in, they're like held for temporarily, immediately put in the judge. They are, this is someone who's then, what is that process? Just so people truly understand also what makes up jail and prison, and that this is not just like a quick turnover.
Yeah. So the majority of things in the criminal system, first of all, are misdemeanors. They're misdemeanor offenses. Felonies are make up very little of it. Like I said, it's 80% is misdemeanors, traffic offenses, and lower than that crimes. So in New York City, if you get arrested and charged with a crime, you wait. You're probably going to wait somewhere between, let's say, a day, like less than, hopefully less than 24 hours, unless, you know, often what happens to if you look for medical treatment, people will call the police because they wanted somebody to get taken to the hospital or they needed medical treatment, and the police will take them and then wait outside their door and arrest them the minute they get out the doctor. And now you're stuck in jail longer for your arraignments. But generally you should get arraigned within 24 hours. Once you get arraigned and you have the case, assuming they don't set bail on you and send you to Rikers, because Rikers is a pretrial detention center in New York City. That's, people think of Rikers as this infamous jail for bad people, but it's pretrial. So that's where you go if they set bail on you in New York City for anything. So you drove your car without a license, you know, your license is suspended. Yeah, traffic infractions. They regularly in Queens, which is where I worked before, Brooklyn, they arrest the taxi drivers, the people that do Ubers at the airport. They charge them with all kind of traffic infractions all the time and literally give them criminal cases. It's a regular thing. So what happens here is, and when you're charged with a misdemeanor, the prosecutors have 90 days from the time the case starts to get their paperwork that they need in order to pursue the charges. So if you get arrested, you can look at least 90 days. You have at least 3 months of having an open criminal case and all the collateral consequences that come with that. And so then you have a court date. They set your arraignments. They set your court date for the next month. Usually nothing happens, but you got to be there. If you're not there, bench warrant. And what happens is people have jobs, or if they don't lose their job automatically, or they have children. And I remind you, these are all really poor people. So they have the money for childcare. They have all these different things. You miss your court date, bench warrant. But you're looking at least 3 months of having a criminal case. And if longer than that, years. People can spend years with open criminal cases. Like the case I told you, I mentioned with the butter knife in the Walgreens. That case was open for a year before I got it. Like,
A year
of putting that. You have no idea. I got it thrown out eventually, but the lawyer who had it before me had them in treatment court for like a year, like just, you know, absurd. But those are the kind of things.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What do you do to then, how do you then remain, how do you not just get so upset all the time for your clients and at the system? I mean, I know obviously you have the opportunity now and the platform now to really be able to explain the difference between, we've heard so much more about police reform and just abolishing the prison system in general, 2020 was a big proponent of that. Yeah. Was that something that was already in your thought process before 2020? Is this something that you feel like you now have a platform where people are actually listening and trying to take that into consideration? What has been the shift that brings us like current day on how people are responding to police reform?
You know, yes, this, as far as where my role in it, this is always what I've been doing, what I've been saying. Anybody who went to law school with me or went to college with me can tell you I was annoying them with this then. It's just, I swear, they would tell you they were sick of it and now they've gotten on board.
What'd you call it, the gap? You saw the gap.
Yes, I saw the gap. They were, listen, tired of me. And I went to a very prosecutor middle law school, so all my classmates are prosecutors, so they were sick of me. I was the only public defender. Sick of it. Nobody was feeling like, girl, you ain't tired? No, I'm not. But actually, and how I ended up building the platform is pretty organic. My friends kind of told me I should take the show to Twitter, like complain there. And I was like, no, I'm not interested, whatever. But then Cuomo was driving me crazy, trying to roll back bail reform. And I'm like, all right, I need to talk about this. So I had to change my name on Twitter from Papa Slime to my government name. So
Papa Slime?
Papa Slime, Candace. I was trying to chill. Yes, I use Twitter strictly to talk about my shows. I just wanted to be Papa Slime in peace. That's what I used to do on Twitter. And then I changed it. What happened was, I've always been really involved, but I was a legal observer at all the protests in 2020. I'm obviously a PD representing the cases in criminal court. And I feel like advocacy is required beyond the courtroom. I think people think there's an idea that you can change the system from the inside, and that's just not true. Not to me. You become a harm reductionist. Like, that's what I do. And I think that's an essential role in court, to reduce the harms of this system the way that it's already set up. But if I want to change the system, it requires me to go out and talk to the public. And as far as the progress to now, I think, so 2020, Black Lives Matter as a liberation movement, not an organization, became like arguably the largest civil rights movement in history in the country. We actually had over 550 different locations in the country. People were protesting on any given day for months and months on end. And I think a lot of the time when people talk about the movement and they think of it from 2020 to now, they use that as though it's lost steam or it's not doing well. They use it to encourage people or to discourage people from participating in this work. But if you recognize the abolition movement for what it is, which is something that dates back decades and decades and decades and decades and is rooted in the abolition of slavery, you recognize how far we've come that we're even having these conversations on the main stage. Because this has been what you've been studying. Angela Davis, all of them have been talking about abolition and prison reform and all this long before me. People are going to be talking about it after. So we've actually made incredible strides, I would say. And it's about divesting. The whole general movement, what we want to do is we want to divest from this prison system. We recognize, you know, when you hear abolition, I don't expect it to not sound wild, right? If you're raised with a criminal system to believe police, courts, prosecution, prisons, all these things are necessary like water. And I think that's what people think of it. Like, we have to have that. Every society, that's what you're taught. And you think of justice as synonymous to incarceration. It's going to sound crazy to you if somebody says, abolish it. Because it sounded like that to me too. The first time it was presented to me in college, I'm like, and I was someone who knew the system was racist. I was like, don't get rid of all the prisons. That's wild. And then my thesis advisor handed me a book, Our Prisons Obsolete by Angela Davis. And just the mere knowledge that it doesn't have to be like this. Are there other places that do it differently? You don't have to have a war with prisons, or that prisons are man-made institutions that we didn't always have. We had maybe 9 prisons for a vast bulk of this country's history in like California. And then we had a massive prison boom where hundreds of prisons were created in a small period of time. It wasn't always like this. So I think when you realize that begins a process of coming to a place on that. And as far as abolition overall, it's a vision of tomorrow. You know, we recognize it's not going to close. They're not going to close all the prisons today. They're not going to say, close all the prisons, close all the courts, throw it out. It doesn't work like that. But what we're saying is we have a massive prison industrial complex. So we put billions, America puts over $277 billion a year into the prison industrial complex. We have over 2 million people incarcerated. Despite making up only 5% of the world's population, we make up 25% of the world's incarcerated population. So even if you don't want to have a conversation about morality, it doesn't even have to be an appeal to our morals or ethics or the fact that the system is just nothing more but legally sanctioned slavery. It's about results. If we're in the game of public safety, if you believe that we have a system, we need to be able to respond to crime and stop crime, and we have to talk about the way the system isn't doing that. Because we constantly say, we're not safe. All the media constantly, crime, we're in so much danger. But we spend more money on prisons and policing, and we incarcerate more people than anywhere else in the world. So why is this not the safest? Why is this not heaven on earth? Why are the same communities you're calling high crime areas, decades after decades, why are the safest communities not the ones with the highest police presence, but the ones that are the most resourced? So what we're saying is, instead of putting that money into just incarcerating people and condemning crime, quote unquote, let's actually address crime. Let's address the conditions and the environment that is leading to this so we can root it out. And if we put that money, the money that we're putting into incarcerating and policing the most under-resourced communities among us, if we put that money into actually addressing their material needs, their education, their healthcare, their housing, the different issues that are leading them there, we would eventually do away with the need for this system altogether. So that's the idea.
Do you feel that I feel like mental health and mental illness comes up a lot as well.
Yes.
And it's just shocking to me that there isn't more attention being brought onto that within this country. Is that something that you see consistently come across your desk? Is that something that
absolutely
it just shocks me that that's not a bigger part of the conversation?
Absolutely. And it's not just, I want to think of it too beyond just 20 to 30% of the people that are currently incarcerated are dealing with would be characterized as serious mental health issues. So not just, you know, depression or other just mental health issues in general, but serious, really, really serious. But in general, how our mental wellness has so much to do with how we respond to life, how we do with anything. I tell people this all the time. Like, I'm such a better person when I'm financially doing well. Okay. I am a nicer person. I'm going to respond to situations so much better. When I see my therapist twice a week, when my bills are paid, when things are looking good, I respond to life well. But if I am not, if life is going poorly for me, if I am, I don't have the money to pay my bills, if I'm incredibly stressed out, I respond to things worse. I'm more likely, when I'm having a good day, Candace, when my bills are paid and they're talking crazy about me online, I'm like, whatever, I'm blessed. When I got bills due, when I got stress on me, when I don't have help, I'm like, I might have to curse somebody out. You know what I mean? You're far more likely to, you know, that, and I think that plays into it. And we got to really, that's why not only is mental health such a heavy part of what the contributing factors to crime, but it's not even just when you think of a person as incredibly mentally ill. It's also the things that are just, how do they respond to it? What situations are they in? You know, how are their depression, stress, all these different things impacted. So that's why like mental health and poverty and these things are so inextricably woven, right? Because poverty, it's incredibly expensive to be poor. Like being poor is the most stress that you'll ever be in life. When you hear about people talking about being down and out, life, even anybody tells you the worst aspects of their life, their finance is something to do about how life is treating them, how things are going, career, financially. So if you live in communities and societies where most people in your community don't have the money for housing to live properly. They don't have the money to eat the way they want, you know, they don't have the money for education. They don't have the money for mental health care. All these things not only compound your situation, but it compounds the way everybody around is dealing with one another, how they interact with one another, how much patience they have for life's problems. And that creates and compounds crime.
I feel like right now, especially if you turn on the news, there's so many videos of just like crime. See, this is what happens when you defund the police.
Except the police aren't defunded.
And then also I'm like, well, we also just went through a global pandemic and there's bigger things going. It's not
right.
Like it was just a normal couple of years where we're like, why is crime up? It's like, and there's inflation.
They never want to talk about it, Candace. Like, that's something I find, as someone who lives in New York City, they're constantly talking about, oh, the homeless. Well, also, somehow that conversation is always completely divorced from housing.
Yeah.
I never make sense. They're like, New York City has this major homeless crisis. New York City's average rent is over $4,000.
Yeah.
It's an unlivable place.
Exactly.
Like, it's an incredibly expensive place. People are not, you think people want to live on the street? Like, you think they're homeless because they want to be homeless? Like, they just want to be a pain in your ass? Yeah. Or do you think they want housing? And that somehow is always left out of it. I think it's interesting when they talk about New York City. Isn't it funny? New York City, Chicago, LA, every place that they pinpoint is like, crime. The most expensive cities to live in the world.
Yes.
Like, that has so much everything to do with it. And specifically, you know, them talking about crime, this crime rise, which is not real in New York City. Now, let's just say it's a fiction that New York Post and Eric Adams and everybody committed to fighting bail reform has invested themselves in. But let's say it is true. let's give it to them, or that crime has risen. New York City, literally, how many businesses? We shut down for longer than most places. Businesses closed down. They lifted all of the moratoriums or the eviction moratoriums. So people immediately, after months and months of not being able to pay rent, people losing their jobs, businesses not getting any help, any surplus, any of that, they immediately started evicting all kinds, thousands of people. And then they're like, we have a homeless crisis. We have a crime crisis. Yeah, why is that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's probably why. It was like literally a pandemic, my guy.
Yes. And I think also if we could, as a society, just go like, oh, yeah, addiction is real. And maybe if there were actual resources for families or anyone that was struggling with addiction and also not putting them in the most like in affluent areas where people then can't rehabilitate themselves through their process and then have to like find a place in the neighborhood that they can't afford to even be in.
Exactly.
And then maybe if, you know, it just again, I think that that's what I feel like a lot of people have. Do you feel like the word like, the term political fatigue starts to come through a lot where people are like, I don't know how to emotionally handle everything that's being brought to me because I can't fix it right now.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that?
Me personally, no, but that's also why I think I should be doing the work. Let me say this. I don't think everybody, especially with Black and marginalized people themselves, but I don't think everybody should feel like obligated. And we all have different roles to play, right? Like life is hard. Life is incredibly hard. It's quite literally the hardest thing we'll ever do. Life is hard and it is both long and short, right? Like, so I don't think that's everybody's day to day. I think we all have to figure out whether or not we have a place in a movement, whether you think that's, you know, what we should be doing and how we contribute to that. There are people that I think like, you know, they think you think because you're a lawyer that that's the main way. But I think educators are incredibly important, like if not the most important to me in terms of what we need to do for shifting the minds and social consciousness of people. But everybody has a different role. So I think if you feel inherently, there are a lot of people that just, that's not for them. Like I have a friend of mine works in like finance and he'll talk to me about, you know, these issues and he'd be like, but I can't, I'm not a protest guy. I'm not a this, it's not, what's not natural for him. And I'm not gonna make him go do something that's not natural for him, but he will go write a piece and try to explain like, oh, the economic, how financially and economically we could do better things, you know, to help the community in this way and blah, blah, blah. Everybody has a different role. For me, I'm a professional loudmouth. I've never stopped running my mouth since I was born. Okay, my movie can tell you that. Like, if I weren't talking about this, I would be talking. So if it comes naturally to me to do this work that I think is important, I'm like, let me do it. But as far as everybody else, I think people got to give themselves grace. We're just people. I don't think anyone, there's no individual person that is set up or has the ability to just consume constant, you know, just constant sadness, constant misery, to put the whole, you know, the whole system on their back. No one of us can do it. This is just trying to figure out what little way can I participate if I can at all. Some people just don't have that benefit. And that's why it's really important on the people that can. You have the time and energy and the privilege in some respects. Because I do look at myself as having a privilege in being able to advocate around these things and go do that. Like I'm a Black woman, I'm an immigrant, I'm all kinds of stuff. But I'm also, I don't got no children. I live here with a cat. You know, there's so many things, there's so many stressors I don't have that makes me more inclined and it's better and easier for me to go run my mouth all day long, you know? And then it's not going to be easier for somebody else. I just think it's about giving yourself the grace, you know, allowing yourself to feel tired, allowing yourself to complain. Like, it's not going to be a rosy world where you wake up and some days I'm like, wow, I would like to be a 29-year-old hot girl and not talk about Rikers this morning, but I got to talk about it. But you give yourself the moments, and I go and I complain to my friends, I go buy art, I go to therapy, I harass my cat. Like, so I think it's about giving yourself grace, you know, letting yourself feel tired when you feel tired, but also just like checking in and be like, well, what's my role in a movement? What can I do? How can I help, if at all?
What are the moments that have given you hope? Then what are the good days? What are the cases where, is there a case as a public defender where you've had a moment of just where you get to feel good?
Yes. I will say it is often surprisingly not even the cases where you do the best work. Like, there are lots of cases where I make a miracle happen. And let me give you an example. The first case, I think this was like my first case. It was a DUI that it was this old Black lady too. So an old Black lady, I'm a child to her. She's not taking me seriously. She's not checking for me. She does not consider me a real lawyer. One time she said it to me at a hearing, like, maybe be a real lawyer one day. And so I
You're like the Doogie Howser of lawyers at the time.
And I had this DUI that it was transferred to me. So I just started the job and it was transferred to me. A much more senior attorney had had it for maybe like 2 years. It's this thick file. And I go to my supervisor at the time and I'm like, hey, I actually think I could get this. You don't feel like this is facially insufficient? Like I could get this dismissed. And she was like, Limey, you need to learn the worth of the case. You know, this is a, you need to go plead this out, you know, da 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 da. And I was like, and then when I talked to the lady, because I'm young, she just wasn't having it. Every time she would call me and she would tell me what a friend of hers said and blah, blah, mind you, it's like not the, like, the Rikers Bar Association is something to be stressed out when friends are consulting about the law. They're like, no, 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 go tell a lawyer that. And I, when I say to you, I spent so much energy trying to figure out how to get this woman's case dismissed, just vanish this DUI that was so, they were not trying to, and I did it. And I was so, you don't understand the hype I thought when I, you know, got to court, you know, I mean, like to tell this lady, like, so she walks into court and I'm like, I was like, your case was dismissed and sealed. She was like, she was like, all right, yeah, bye. Like, did not care. And I'm like, mind you, then I'll have clients where I feel like I did nothing. And the parent, the family will call me, like my first favorite client, the first favorite client I ever had, his dad called me to tell me basically like his son, he's like, you have no idea, but he had wanted to take his life. Like you had this conversation with him and these blah, 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 and getting him this help. Like that means so much to our family. And I'm like, wow, you know, I represented this kid that he had an old black Grammy and she was, you don't know how happy she was when she saw me representing her grandson and dealing with that case. So there are definitely moments, lots and lots of moments that I'm like, wow, that was beautiful. Like that was, or I'm glad that, you know, it was me. Or one time in court this year, actually, I heard an accent, like I heard my own accent and I don't hear the Bahamian accent. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, and I was like, what was that? I was like, all right, man. And I'm like, and it wasn't even my case. Like court was about to close. It was super late or whatever. And I'm like, let me call this person. I'm like, give me your mom's number. Let me call your mom. Let me get in contact with them. And then let me arraign this case. Like I'll stay late. Let me arraign this and get them out. And the way that Bahamian woman, like that never happens. Like my island, the Bahamas is a collection of 700 islands and keys, but my island, Nassau, the capital, is only 21 by 7 miles long. We're tiny people. And we are Bahamians are in the Bahamas. Like I live in Little Caribbean in Brooklyn, but you have everybody else but us. I'm the only Bahamian here. So it doesn't happen that I run into a Bahamian. But when I did, I was able to like help this Bahamian woman, the joy. So I remember calling my mommy, like I don't know how that worked out for her, but it did. And so yeah, there are lots of moments that I feel really good about stuff. And there at the same, the flip side, there are sad ones, but it's usually not what you think it's going to be. Like I had this man, his name, I don't remember him, but he was from Augusta, Georgia. And I always remember that because he said it real cute like that. I barely did anything for him. And he would be like, when he was leaving on his final day, he was like, thank you, miss. And he just dropped this little like compact mirror in my hand and skidoodled out of court. And I was like, my heart.
I would assume like that's what I would probably need to keep going, or yeah, just like those little moments of just humanity and connecting with the people that you're representing, because otherwise it would feel and I know that's what you signed up for, and I know that's what you specifically sought out when you knew that you were going to become a public defender, but to see the bright moments, I'm sure really, really help get through the days.
It does.
Okay. As far as how can we at this point, if someone's listening right now and they're like, I've only heard about, you know, police reform or defunding the police, like, where do I start? Like, all of these words seem scary to me and I am like too scared to even dive into it or take a step into it, because then it's going to become a thing. And then if I try to talk about this with family or friends and I even ask a question, it's going to be this huge debate. If there's anyone listening right now who doesn't even know how to enter the conversation, where is a good place for them to start?
There are a bunch of books that I could recommend, and like people or wherever that you could follow. For me, the first thing I want to say is give yourself grace. Do not expect yourself to immediately become a scholar overnight or take on the challenge of feeling like you got to convince all your family members and everybody around you. You know, oftentimes it's about getting our own selves educated, you know what I mean? And trying to unlearn things and work through ourselves and tangentially giving information out as we can. Cause I am a major abolitionist and my mama is not an abolitionist. I just want to know, like sometimes, especially I feel like we give white people in specific a lot of pressure and I think you should be talking to your families and educating them, whatever, in time when you can. But the idea that like, you got to go change them all, put them all on your back, and it's the whole family and your friends and everything. It doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. You can be a literal scholar and expert. And every day my mama's like, girl, you know, so like every day she's like, you think you know? I'm like, no, but I do know mama. Like, I know you're my mama, but I'm like literally kind of an expert. Like, but I would start personally. I always try to advise people to start with like, Our Prisons Obsolete. I think Angela Davis's book, Our Prisons Obsolete, is a great starting mark. I think from there, I think you can also look at, there's a thing called 10 Demands Can't Wait, or the role. If you Google 10 Demands, it's the Roll Over to Abolition website, and they have so much. They literally have condensed it into a pretty easy to manage thing. Like, oh, these are the 10 steps on how, what the vision is towards abolition. And they have a lot of resources and links there, and they can direct you to the people. I would say 10 Demands is a good website, a good resource to start with. But Our Prisons Obsolete, there's also a book called We Do It Till We Free Us by Mariam Kaba. That's a good place to start. There's also a book called Becoming Abolitionist by Derica Purnell. And there's a book called End of Policing by Alex Vital. I think those are all beautiful places to start. But also, I think that, you know, people underrate it, but Twitter is like, there's so many of us that you can get connected, follow, and start learning from. And people, you know, people love to downplay it because they don't like the fact that Twitter is as powerful as it is. But a lot of what is our news forces, news media, these things are being driven by the conversations and the organizers and the people that are on Twitter, you know, giving the information and putting it out on the ground. So I would say start there. Start by reading like Our Prisons Obsolete, get that book and start getting acquainted with it. Our Prisons Obsolete is for me, that was my beginning to this journey. And I didn't become an abolitionist overnight, and I couldn't tell you what night it happened, but Our Prisons Obsolete, that's my starting.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I also, you mentioned Twitter and just social media in general, and just, yes, you know, going onto your social media. I love, there's also on your website, you had this great, it was basically, you were like, a lawyer looks like a lawyer. You're a lawyer, yeah, because you, or you look like a lawyer because you are a lawyer.
Are a lawyer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because I think, especially as women, it, in what would usually be considered a like male dominated place at one point, that you cannot then be someone who is considered a professional, but then also, yes, a feminine, you know, someone who embraces their sexuality. You can't, yeah, be like daytime lawyer and then also just like a, yeah, nighttime, like just woman and like person in the world.
I get the streets at all. Yeah.
But I love that so much. Is there, if, like, what do you have other women approach you and asking like, oh my gosh, how did you get to that point of just being like, yeah, I can be all the things?
I realized I couldn't be less than it. I wanted, like, listen, I, in a different world, I am not an extrovert by choice. I am just incredibly highly animated. And just through no fault, this is just my personality type. But throughout life, I've wanted to be a more in like wallflower type of person, because I felt like people would leave me alone. You know, when you're a lot, people see you, they analyze you, they have thoughts. I can be a polarizing character, right? Because I'm a lot. Even if people either love me or they hate me. There's usually not an in between. Because if you like a certain kind of thing that I am, you're gonna love it. I'm a lot of that. But if you don't like that kind of thing, you're going to hate it. I'm a lot of that. So, but I remember, I think when I settled into this is who I am and I can't do anything about it was right before I started my job as a public defender, my first job at a law school. I was like, I really just want people to leave me alone. I don't want nobody to think about me. I'm going to try to mute myself as much, be my cutest, most reserved version of me. And then one time in training, my coworker Royce was like, oh, I didn't know what room he was supposed to be in, but I just followed the sound of Alami's laughter in from the hallway. And I was like, damn, this is my quiet version. Like, and then I was like, oh, you might as well hang it up. I was like, just go ahead and hang it up. You can't do nothing about it, right? And then actually, this being this person is kind of what launched me into any kind of Twitter popularity of some kind. It was actually in 2020, before I don't even think I had 200 followers in like June of 2020, July. So what happened was I called this lady racist, because she was. it was this lady that worked for my, she actually works for my job. And so she was a school segregationist. Like she was like racist in a, like not like racist, like an academic racist, she was like racist in a like, high racism type of way. She's like, she literally doesn't want Black people and poor people in the schools with her white children. That's her literal position.
That was the actual platform that she would, that's what her soapbox she was standing on.
A literal segregationist. And so when she was being called a racist all throughout the news, because she's a racist, she was like, I can't be a racist. I'm a public defender. And I was like, ooh, 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 ooh.
Nope, nope.
I was like, ma'am, ma'am, don't get the job in it. And so, when I called her racist, I do not think they were, you know, it's so funny. People so often create the adversaries they most fear. Some white guy lawyer in New York City who had like 600 followers, which was a lot to my not any followers, child, he decided he was just so upset about me calling this lady a racist. So I got a call. It was on my birthday too. It was on my 27th birthday. I got a call from all these lawyers that I work with, like, oh my God, Alami, like there's this guy like sharing your pictures on Twitter. I'm like, what pictures? What poo?
That was the worst call anyone could get. This day, like, let's just be honest.
I was like,
that's terrifying.
Oh, my chest. I was like, excuse me, what pictures? I go on Twitter.
You're like, what year was that? Wait, when was that? Wait, when right. Did that go? Hold on.
You should see me. I was like, who is done watching me? I go on Twitter. And it's like my birthday pictures I tweeted myself. Like, and this guy's like from like a spam account, and he's sharing my pictures and he's going, if you want to see somebody who used their body and their race to get a job, then I'll show you exhibit A. I'm like, so you think I'm hot? Thank you. I'm like, you know, so that, because he did that, he was sharing that all these lawyers, I didn't even know there was a law Twitter, were like, so because I'm an unconventional type in the sense that a lot of lawyers play the game as more reserves, more this, you know, they're not familiar. They weren't familiar with a person like me at the time. So for them, that's like terrifying. Like, look at this person, your regular pictures are standing up. I'm like, so they're all like waiting on my response. And I come through and I'm like, listen, I've looked like this since I was 13. I've been this person. Like, I'm very accustomed to being sized up and hypersexualized and blah. And I just don't care. I don't get the time to do with it. And I've thought about it and I'm like, listen, I guarantee you, when I'm an old lady on my deathbed, I'm not going to be like, oh, I wish I wasn't giving it up like I was in my 20s. Like, you know what I mean? I'm just not going to do that. I'll be like, damn, I wish I had less cleavage that day.
Oh, like, after two kids now, like, I am just, anytime I see a photo of me when I was in my early 20s, where at the time I was like, oh, God, I'm just putting it all out there. Now I'm like, yes, thank God. That is photographic. That is never going away. It is there.
Yes.
I looked like that at some point.
Yes, exactly. And that's how I feel. I'm like, quite frankly, and I remember, so that kind of is what started my following. And I remember at first I was like, all these law students, everybody loved me. Like I'm so, and I remember saying to my bestie, Mark, I was like, I don't care what the big deal is. And he was like, Alami, let me ask you something. Do you know any lawyer? Remember you're in law school, you know any lawyers like you? And I was like, no, you're right. Like, and I still don't. Like, so I'm like, all right, that makes sense. I just, honestly, people, it's easier to be authentic. That's just one. It's just easier. It's just a far more efficient. And also too, like I said, if you're the person where it's easier for you, it's easier for me to just be this and accept the criticism and people, you know, I just don't care. I just happen to be the kind of person that just doesn't give a damn. So I rather do that. And that way it makes it easier for Black women behind me and other women behind me, not just Black women, but any woman that feels like, let me look like this. Let me be whatever. Let me be, because you can't dispute it. And the funny thing is people get used to stuff. It's like, remember when, I'm not going to use him as the example because he's really acting up. Let me go Rihanna. But you remember Rihanna first came out and people couldn't even say her name. Like they couldn't say her name right. They would say all these things that act like they don't understand her accent. Now there's nobody alive that doesn't know how to say Rihanna because people adjust and they get it. I have been 2 years ago, everybody had so much to say about all my sexy fits and my boobs and now they're accustomed to it. Now they don't say anything. They just saw me titties out on the weekend and then they saw me in the news on Monday. No complaint. They get it. They come to respect you. Now they, my name, they learn how to pronounce it. So people will get accustomed. And by the time that becomes normal, you know, people, it was abnormal. When I first read locks, my mom used to have someone say something, red locks, tattoos, whatever. They don't even see it in the same way they once did. And that normalizes and makes it easier for other women. And it also just makes it easier for me to do what I want to do. So that's my...
Well, it's also the same. You don't have to, there is no like one way to, like if you're a lawyer, you're a fucking lawyer. Right. You know what I mean?
Right. It's always people who don't do what you do telling you what you can't do. Once it was viral because this lady, my headshot, the same one I sent y'all, which you say I am a perfectly professional photo. This lady was like, I checked with my husband and this photo's too busty. You should crop it. Like you should crop it here. That's what she told me. And it was like a lady who considered herself like a fan of mine too. Like a fan. Like everybody, she thought she was helping me. And I was like, well, I'm not that nice. Sorry. I didn't respond to her kindly. It went viral. And which is actually how my Nigerian family found me. And I was like, oh Lord, of all the important work that I do, I'm viral in Nigeria for saying fuck you, lady.
I also just don't understand I don't know if it's the American, I am assuming it's truly an American obsession with just either wanting breasts bigger or smaller.
Yeah.
It's like the Goldilocks of boobs in this country. It's like no one can wear them just right. It is insane to me how many incredible, like, you know, very scholarly women that I talk to all the time. And how much they have to consider, like, what they're wearing is going to be a reflection of how people think they're going to perform at their job.
And that's why you got to stop enabling it. You got to stop legitimizing it. You know, people, again, if you just stop playing the game, they don't got a game to play with. You know what I mean? You just kind of stop. I just stopped dealing with it. I remember, you know, funny enough, I like I said, I always knew I was going to be a lawyer. So I got my first tattoo on my ankle when I was 15. And I remember I chose my ankle because I'm all going to be a lawyer. I don't want it to be somewhere you could see, blah, 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 blah. Only to then in 2020 as an attorney get like 10. They're like, just because I'm sitting down bored. My mom called me actually because there was an example of why you should be authentic. I got tagged in a conversation that were some law students on Twitter are talking about how they wanted a tattoo. And some lawyers came in like, you can't do that. Like, you're a lawyer, be professional. And they tagged, they're like, Mr. Lurin is our lawyer with tattoos and on the news. And I was like, you're right. You can't beat that. You can't beat them fast. So I think it's important to just do it, you know. And I also think there's a beauty in yourself, in a comfort you feel in yourself, you know, when you realize that you did it all. Like, it's one thing to be, you know, successful or accomplish the things you want to do, but it's another thing to do it on your own terms and to be like, yeah, like I really did that. I did that. I'm like, you know, I said to myself, like, some lady actually told me on the weekend, was like, commented on my Instagram, like, Miss, we don't want to see all your goodies. We here for political things. I was like, I don't care what you want to see. You can get the F out of here. And then I was on Dawn Oliver that night. And I was like, say, and what? Tell me again. You know, like,
I can do both. Yeah.
We have to allow ourselves to be multidimensional people or they'll keep slicing and dicing us up. And something I recognized a long time ago is people, when they meet people or they see people, they come up with an idea of you. They just do. They come up with a box of perception of you and they put you in it and they will distort everything. No matter what you show them or give them about yourself, they will keep distorting it to fit that lens. So you just got to dismiss it. Like, people tell me there's so many things people think about me that I'm just like, I'm a nerd, like a whole, you see literally nothing but anime and stuff behind here, but they busy hypersexualizing me all day like I'm a city girl. Then at the same time, they're talking about me like I'm a radical maniac. I'm just like, child, I guess it's all true. Whatever, I'm in my house kicking it.
I also love that you just get like the craziest phone calls or like text messages being like, hey, there's pictures of you on the internet. And then it's like this life-changing occurrence. It's actually the start of something new. Hey, by the way, you're on John Oliver tonight. And you just like, so all the amazing, like life-changing moments that come through your phone. I just cannot wait to see what text you get next. Which means you
how I felt about this one. When I got this email, just so you know, Gavis, when I got this email on my friend's phone, I was like, excuse me. I like major talks, everybody, literally my meeting before this. I was like, I don't know if you all know, and I do know y'all know because I know y'all watch The Vampire Diaries because we all did. Like, yes, and I'm not gonna lie, I want you to know I'm not gonna let you leave here before I ask you what I want to ask you.
Oh, absolutely. Allow me, let's go. What you want to know?
Okay, first of all, I don't know why I seem to be the only person in this fandom and that like I am upset. Why is nobody but me shit Tyler and Caroline? Why am I the only one that's upset about that? I feel so upset. Listen, I'm so mad. I've been mad for years, Caroline.
That's
like
hilarious.
Ooh, I'm so tight. I'm like, why? Like, you know what I don't like? It's y'all's fault because I think y'all as actors did a better job than they wanted y'all to do. Like, clearly they didn't decide that was Endgame, but y'all acted the hell out of that Endgame because I was invested, okay? I was like, I believe y'all, this is Endgame and everything, and then suddenly they're moving y'all on. And I was like, we're never going to get back to this?
That's hilarious. I know, it is funny, by the end of it, the running joke was that literally Caroline Forbes had a romantic love interest with almost every single character on the show.
Showed it.
To the point where like there was like a, when the babies came, it was like, wait, which one can be the father? Because it has to be someone new. And I mean, it was very funny. I very rarely get asked about the Tyler and Caroline shipping, which is it's always Caroline and Klaus or Caroline and Stefan. That's what I get.
And it doesn't make sense to me because I'm like, you know, bless their heart, but Caroline and Stefan, child. I was like, I don't know where y'all. I was like, who's a part of this? I was like, who do you need to write a letter to? Like, why? What do they got? When they murked, I was the only person. I was like, murking, take him out the game, finish it. Like, yes. I was like, fine. And then they didn't give my girl. I'm like, all right, okay, fine. Maybe y'all, they got the originals. They're going to give my girl to Klaus. Then they can't do another stuff. I was like, well, you might as well give me what I wanted. and that was my end game. But no, I was alone in that. And I've been sick about it. And I cannot tell you how happy I am that I get to tell you direct. Like, oh, this is, thank you. I've been tight. Well, who's your favorite? What did you want to happen?
Oh, man. No, I was just happy that I had a job. I mean, it was always very fun. And like, it was fun that, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world to be like, okay, we've been making out for a season. Who do I get to make out with next? You know, it's like very, none of it's very romantic. It's, you know, you're making out in a sweaty warehouse with like 100 crew people just staring at you waiting for their lunch. But other than that, no, I honestly was just thrilled to always have a job and realized this last weekend, we were like on a panel at a Comic-Con in Europe, and someone had asked about like death, like the craziest death on the show, and there was a whole group of us there, and I realized that everyone on the stage had been a character that died, even like lead, you know, very big lead characters.
Yeah.
But I literally just did an episode of Legacies earlier this year where like I was one of the last ones standing of them all. So I might not have gotten like a relationship out of the end of it, but like,
but you got a life.
But I got a life.
You got a life.
13 years.
Yeah, no, Caroline was a very surprisingly, I think she's probably one of, if not the best developed cat. I mean, it probably is the best, which is why she's still around, because she's surprising when the show starts off. You think you're going to hate her. Like, you're like, oh, I hate this annoying gal.
I got that a lot. Yeah, I got that a lot. Yep.
And then somehow it's like, oh, I love me some Caroline. I'm so here for it. I'm like, why are they doing my gal like this? Oh, I love it. I'm like, yes. I went from like, I hate Caroline to like, yes, it makes sense why all the men like, yes, give her Klaus, give her everybody. And I like them all because, listen, I will remain on Team Tyler until I die. But you, Klaus, I can't lie. I can't lie. As a Tyler fandom for you and Tyler, I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna lie. Klaus really. I was like, I see it. I see the Klaus and Caroline.
That
I do get
so
it.
Funny. The funny thing is like, I adored working with Joseph Morgan. I know that like he enjoyed working with me, but there was no like, the only reason that the writers even kept writing that storyline was because of Twitter. Because of Twitter at the time. There wasn't even Instagram that existed at the time. And it would just become this trending thing. And they were like, well, no, we're not writing that. But we'll give them one more scene because we have other plans.
Stop doing your job so good. Stop Stop doing it so good. Stop chemistrying it up. Listen, the scene in the woods. Listen, I was in my house like, you know what? They really did that because I wanted to hate Klaus because you know what I mean? I wanted to hate him so bad. First of all, that man is talented. That character is dynamically done fantastic. In a way that is outrageous because when I said he got so mad, he came in there messaging up for Tyler. Like I was hot. I was like, how they gonna tell? Oh, I was mad. I was like, they gonna take a main love interest. They just gonna act like it never happened. They gonna make him the servant to Klaus and he gonna steal his girl. Oh, I'm so mad. But then y'all didn't know what to do. I was like, okay.
Well, that scene in the forest where it's basically like they hook up for the first time. And for anyone that hasn't seen it, and funny enough, just going back to making sure that there's like digital proof of like how things were in the youth as far as like femininity and like body and sexuality. We got there and he was like, Joseph was supposed to take a shirt off that day too. And he was just like, I'm not doing it. I don't want to do it. I don't need it, which is completely within his rights. But I knew what the people wanted. They wanted some steam. They wanted, you know, I'm a TV watcher.
Like, yes.
I want to be able to envision myself in those situations. And I was like,
yes.
Don't worry, guys. I will take one for the team and I'll take my shirt off. Someone and I wear the little bra. So you're welcome.
Someone got it. Listen.
I took one for the team and took my shirt off for a steamy against a bark tree. You know, just lovemaking session.
A timeless contribution that we all appreciate. It might have been the nail in my boy Tyler's casket, and I hate that. And when they took my boy out the game and at the end and didn't even give him no fanfare. Oh, I was mad. I was so mad when they told Caroline. She just was like, I was like, oh, so you're just going to act like that wasn't the love of your life? We're just going to be like this. We're just going to be like this. You're just not going to address it? Like,
oh, man. Well, you need to moderate one of our panels at some Comic-Con in the world. This
I want
would
you to
be
know if
amazing.
That ever in any way happens, y'all will not be able to tell me nothing. Don't call me. Nobody call me a limey. Call me the lawyer formerly new. Yes, I would be too hyped.
Well, a limey, I love to do a little cool down at the end of every podcast just to get to know our guests just a little bit better right before we say goodbye to them. I have five questions for you that I ask everyone.
Yes, I'm ready.
So one is going to be just very simple. What's something you like?
Plants.
Plants?
Some plants. Oh. Yeah, I'm a plant. I got like 50 plants in here. Plant mama. Yes. And
that's what I want to be. I want to be a plant person so bad. But
I was surprised I became one. I became one in the pandemic. It was nothing. Let me just say this. In the pandemic, there was nothing open but the plant store in my neighborhood, the plant store, the tattoo shop. And that's it. So I got like 15 tattoos, 50 plants. I swear I
plants
did.
My mom, tattoos.
I swear I did. My mommy would call me. I would buy my friends. Well, it was ridiculous. Like I've spent thousands of dollars. I'm not joking. Like,
oh, no, I believe you. You can.
But plants. And then like, even look, I have plants tattooed all
over. Do you have a plant tattoo?
Me.
That was going to be my next question. That's hilarious.
Rose, plants, tattoo. When my mom called me, my niece was like, oh, I want a tattoo. And my mommy was like, No, you can't get a tattoo and be a professional. She was like, Alami has one. So my mommy calls me and to get the important. She was like, oh, Alami was serious about it. She thought about it. My niece calls me and goes, Alami, how come you got that tattoo? I was like, oh, I thought it would be wavy.
I love it. Plants. All right. Okay. What's something that you know?
Tree kangaroos I love me some tree kangaroos. They're endangered and they're in the trees of Papua New Guinea. They have like little thicker feet so that they can walk among the trees. And they're like 11 different species of tree kangaroos and they spend like 64% of their lives sleeping. And I love that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Tree kangaroos. Okay. Yes. That's, I'm going to do a very big Google deep dive after
and
this.
Did you know how the average sloth dies?
No.
The average sloth. sloths be in the
heart
tree,
attack.
They're so silly. You know, sloths be in the trees with their long arms, so they swing from tree to tree. They mistake their own arm for a tree branch and fall out the tree. Silly, silly babies.
Mm-hmm. They are silly. Sloths are very. They've also like been such a trending animal of like the past couple of years. Sloths
because
have been very
it.
Hot. Yes,
we're tired. They resonate with our spirit.
Yes. Okay. So, what's something that you hate?
Child, so many things. Let's see. What do I hate off the top of my dome?
Besides the ending of Caroline and Tyler's relationship.
Child. hate. You know what's crazy? I complain all day. You would think I would have so many things off the top of the dome. Goku, he's a deadbeat. You say I got Vegeta. Like, I have Vegeta and them and Piccolo and Bulma and Yamcha and everybody here and Frieza, but Goku's a deadbeat and he does not deserve any of the praise, so I'm going to go choose him. And The Notebook.
I love it.
I hate the movie The Notebook.
Unpopular. You hate the movie The Notebook?
Unpopular opinion. It's a laugh.
Why? Was there like one thing that stands out from it that you're like...
The whole thing. It's nothing. The whole thing. I'm like, what about this man choosing to give his life, his whole life to this gal who's barely interested in him for half the film? Why don't we encourage him to get therapy? What about this? Sometimes like me and my friend have been recently doing this thing where we realize we're the toxic person. You don't realize it because as a woman in this scenario, I'm like, oh, you know, I understand me. I don't intimidate me. I get me in my main focus. You don't even realize it's you. She don't like him like that. He is not like, we watched the movie from his like, oh, he love her. And as women, we like it because it's nice to see yourself be the number one main priority of a man. But if we actually thought about his feelings, this is a sad film. It's a sad ass movie. Our guy needed some therapy. He needed some self-confidence. He needed another girl. He needed to love himself. It's a rough movie.
I would love to see like a remake of that, but with that turn in it. That would be amazing.
I would love it.
But then they end up at the same retirement home. And then he just gets to be like, let me tell you. Like how I lived my life. And I chose, yes.
That would be beautiful.
That would be great. All right, we're going to work on it. And then something that you love.
My cat, Raheem. That's my baby.
How old is he?
He is 3. Aww. He is a big tuxedo Maine Coon. I love him. He used to be the terror of the streets. He used to run around messing cats up. Like, no, he really didn't play. Like, Raheem is a former G. So how I got Raheem actually was my cat had passed and one of my Twitter followers sent me an ad to a cat in Bushwick Cats, a place that rescues cats in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I was like, I do not want a new cat. Like, but then I saw him and let me just say this to you. My cat looked crazy. Cat is like effing crazy. The only reason I got him was because I was like, nobody is taking this cat in. First of all, I'm gonna show you what he looked like, but this is what the ad said. They said he invaded a feral cat colony, not a cat colony. He invaded a colony full of feral cats and beat the brakes off them, beat up every cat so that he could get their food. So they had to trap him. They literally said we had to trap an interloper in our midst. They trapped him so because he was stealing all the food from other cats, and they sent him away to a place for bad feral cats. Turns out he's not feral. He's just hungry and he liked to fight. So they had him. He had FIV. He was fighting, looking crazy. I'm going to show him to you right now, Candace, because if you see what he looked like, he is handsome and beautiful now. But child, and my mommy was like, you cannot get that Ted Bundy looking cat. You cannot get him. Like, and I was like, let me show this.
And he just needed to be loved and get some good meals. Oh my gosh.
Look crazy. He looked absolutely nuts. And I brought him in, and the minute I was like, well, I'm gonna foster him. I swear to you, Raheem walked in the house, like slugged up, he's real big. And he like walks around the house, he goes and eats his food, and he's like, this is nice. This is nice, this is a good gig. Jumps in the bed, he's like, we homies, we friends, and I love you, I'm staying here. I'm like, what do you wanna be named? I call him Raheem, he responded immediately like, you got that right. Uh-huh,
oh,
that's
my
baby.
Goodness.
Yes, love him.
I love that. Okay, and then one quirky fact about you.
You know, so many things about me are so like, ridiculous on its face that it's so hard to choose. I'm probably gonna choose sometimes I be like anytime I can't I lose my bearing, which is often. I'm like, oh, what would an alimony do if I were, you know what I mean, where would an alimony put that, what would an alimony do, like a species. And sometimes one time in court or in the office, I'm like forget my bearings while I'm walking around my work office, I think no one's there, and I'm just in the hallway and I'm like, where would an alimony go? I look up and hear my colleagues like that. I think that's the most ridiculous thing. I walk around the streets like, and a lion is supposed to be where now? And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm here. That's the one.
I love that though. I love it's like this like higher version of yourself that is like,
it lets me know I understand really like me when that. I get the answer right. Like when I'd be like, if I'm lost something, I'd be like, where in a lion put her keys? And I figure out where in a lion would put her keys.
I really love that. I call it in therapy right now. I'm like, there is this logical part of my brain, and this is what the logical part says. So I can talk myself out of it. But I like this like kind of call to your higher self that you can hear and listen to and kind of guide you. That's fantastic. Well, Eliami, thank you so much for joining me today. And it's such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
This was so fun.
This has been a Super Boom podcast, hosted by me, Candace King, produced by Melissa D. Montz and Diamond Imprint Productions. Post-production sound by Chris Henry, and advertisement partnerships with Acast.